session number 9876, reel 8.
Mr. Dennis, reel 8. You were telling me of an incident when a shell had landed just in front of your
yes.
battery on the Admiral Road position, if you could continue.
Shortly afterwards, I heard the noise again, and a similar German shell landed rather too close for comfort, and the other side of the battery. It was still perfectly possible that these were only casual German rounds, fired as part of a program to harass the area in which we were, and not directly at us. So we had to wait and see. There followed two more rounds, one short and one plus. And I said to Vernon, I think that's it. And he said, so do I. And he blew a whistle, which was a signal. And the men rapidly got off the guns and came back to the old German frontline trench, where their heads were down and there was concrete, and it was away a little bit from there, it was to a flank. Well, I was very relieved that we were all that they'd all got to safety, because the fire increased, and very soon we were getting rounds, not every few minutes, but every few seconds, falling in and round the battery position. And it was getting to look very nasty indeed. The thing that was frightening me particularly was that I knew that if at this point the infantry was attacked and put up an SOS rockets, it would be absolutely essential that we should get all the men back on the guns, whether they were under fire or not. And God knows what we would have lost. But this had happened to another battery, not very distant from us, and they'd lost a great many of their personnel because they couldn't leave the guns. The rule was quite simple. If the infantry are out of the trenches, the gunners have got to stay on the guns. Well, we got no SOS rockets. No SOS rockets from the infantry.
Were there any other circumstances where you had to stay on the guns? Well, I mean,
the only circumstance, I was told you could always test it by saying, if the infantry are out, you mustn't be out of the gun position. If the infantry, they can be out either because they're making an offensive or because the Germans are attacking them. Either because the infantry were moving forward or because they'd put up rockets showing that the Germans were moving towards them. Those were the two circumstances in which you couldn't leave the guns. But here, we had no bad luck of that kind. And we simply stopped and watched detonation after detonation happening in the battery position. At intervals, either Vernon or I would make our way along the German front line trench, which was off center, it wasn't in the middle of this, to see if we got a stray round and if any men had been hurt or anything like that. And nobody had. Not a single man was touched. Well, the afternoon wore on, and we tried to estimate from the speed of the detonations how many batteries were firing on us. And we came to the conclusion that it was probably three. It might be two German 5.9 howitzer batteries, and conceivably an 8-inch German howitzer, or it might be three 5.9 howitzers, something like that. That was only our estimate, but it was that sort of fire. It was what was described as a shoot to destruction. Their idea being that they would they would shoot until we were quite out. It got dark after a bit, and the fire slackened.
So they've been going on for quite some considerable time.
2 or 3 hours, I think. And got dark early, of course, in that weather. And the fire slackened. And I recollect that the Germans were supposed to have a trick of stopping the fire of this kind and waiting until the infantry or the gunners got back and then starting again with very suddenly. And I remembered this story, and I said to Vernon, I think you and I'd better have a look first and see whether it's still all right. And we went out and we had a look, and we found that all the guns had been hit. One was blown in spite of it being 5 tons in weight. It had been completely blown on its back. Obviously it was finished. And another gun was very bad damaged, and then splinters had made a bit of a mess of the other two. And then we went back to our dugout, and I had been right. They did start again, but they didn't go on very long, and I didn't think they'd do it twice. So the second time they stopped, we sent the men back to the gun pits to do what they could to clear up, but it wasn't much. And then we got them back into the trench. Well, after dark, my commanding officer, the major, arrived back from Poppering, and he came into the battery position from the far side from where we were, and he was horrified to find that there wasn't a gun in action. And he thought to himself that he'd find half his men casualties on the ground. He thought we must have been caught. But to his relief, nobody was there. Then he found us, and we explained what had happened. And next day, the ordnance came around, and all our guns were taken. Two were patched up quickly, and the other two we had to wait for some days before new ones arrived. And that was the end of the my own personal battle.
Would that sort of, was it unusual to have batteries firing on you like that? I mean,
oh no, both sides did it whenever they could. Well, both sides, with the aid of their air forces and their observers and so on, tried to locate hostile battery positions, and sooner or later concentrated on one of them and tried to knock it out. We did it too, of course.
Would you move battery position after an experience like that?
Everyone?
Would you move your battery position after?
That was always a question, whether it was worth doing or not. You see, things were fairly evenly balanced. If the Germans had marked us as destroyed, which they probably had, it was likely that they wouldn't want to do it all over again. So that was in favour of using our old position again. On the other hand, you might say that once they'd found where it was, they would try again. And that was an argument for going somewhere else. We stayed there.
Did you have any similar trouble again?
I was never in the battery when it was seriously shelled again from that time. That was the last time I really saw the full orchestra at work. There was another occasion on which we had an offensive, we were supporting it from the same position that we'd been in on Admiral's Road, and we were trying to capture the Pilkem Ridge, which I think we did on that occasion. It was a limited one, very expensive, and only made of a mile and a half, perhaps. So, there. I was in the battery position. I remember the barrage. I hadn't heard a full barrage by us before, and I was quite impressed with the noise it made, and I wondered if the Germans would react and, as they would want to do, whether we'd get shelled, but we weren't. I remember the miserable, filthy, terrified prisoners coming down the duckboards, shoving their hands up if they saw in their body, and various infantrymen. They would have small numbers of infantrymen bringing them in. I think there were Scotsmen on this occasion. I don't think it's a real episode. The joke was that somebody said that the Scots infantry were not massacring the Germans, but that each German was required to hand over his wristwatch.
And who told it? Was that a joke amongst the battery?
That was a joke. I don't know if it's true. Not worth print.
So, during the battle, you'd be there for a day. We're moving on now from the battery position.
We moved on to a position.
No, I mean, sorry, I mean, and that we were running through the routine one day at the front, one day. You would also be at your billets at the canal bank.
Not the canal bank. Our billets now were well forward of the canal bank. They were just a dugout.
And what were your responsibilities or recreations
well,
there?
Well, we used to go around we used to report if there had been short shelling anywhere of the infantry who were complaining. Once or twice I was told by the infantry that there had been short shelling, but I had found out conclusively from the descriptions and so on and the noise that they described that they were not heavy artillery that were doing it at all, but they were some of our field artillery. It was perfectly permissible for them. It was much more excusable for them because they had to shell much closer to the infantry than we did. It would have been very wicked if we'd dropped things short, but it was much, much more allowable for field artillery.
So you went round visiting
them? I went round visiting them.
Where were they when you visited them?
Generally company headquarters. At this time in the war they were mostly in trenches, the men in trenches, and the company headquarters would be an enlarged bit of the trench with anything they could put on top, like railway sleepers if they could get them. And I used to come in and explain who we were, and we were generally pretty kindly treated. I think the infantry probably had a feeling that we had a very easy life compared with them, but then of course we had.
Did you think that at the time, or
Oh, at the time. I mean, we realised that whereas they had to stay there for the whole of their time, and perhaps a week. They used to move them pretty quickly, but they'd have perhaps a week in very unpleasant conditions, wet, lots of shell fire, lots of fear. We would be able to go back out of machine gun range anyway, and even possibly back to billets where we'd be only within range of long fire. Well, I think we all understood perfectly well that the infantry had by far the worst job, but what they didn't always understand was what it was like to be in areas where the Germans were using rather heavy artillery. I remember when we had when there was a period of calm and people were being sent to stay with other units and get used to them. I remember that the infantrymen that we were giving hospitality to Jarvis was very disconcerted by what he thought were enormous shell bursts in the vicinity. Because, of course, if you were further back, you'd get fewer but larger shells.
So that was one of your responsibilities when in the billets.
Well, going round the infantry. Another thing they liked us to do, I don't know why, was to report any movements we saw overhead, of any considerable movements of German planes. So we used to report them occasionally. You were left more or less to do what you liked, only you had to put in a report.
What would that be? What would you put in your report?
Well, you put in that it had been fairly quiet in the morning, that there had been evidence of a good deal of harassing fire in such and such an area, that you'd visited infantry company headquarters here and there, and nobody had any reports of short shelling, and finally that you'd seen a considerable formation of German aeroplanes roughly, you thought, heading towards Ypres. I mean, that was a report. It wasn't very... What was valuable about these things really was to let the different arms of the service meet one another, and anybody who wanted impressing with what the infantry's life was like would get it, and the infantry, I hope, would realise that other people felt sympathetic to them.
Now, while you were here, would you be responsible for the care of your men, the pastoral care?
Ah, no, not then. Each of us had a certain number, each subaltern had a certain number of men whom you had a responsibility for, but you didn't have to go and look at their equipment and that all the time. That would be done normally by the non-commissioned officers. But it is true that some of the men in the battery, if they wanted something, or they wanted to send a confidential letter home or something like that, they would go to their own officer for it. As far as we were concerned, we always gave it. That is worth mentioning, perhaps. The letters were open to censorship, and an officer had to sign that he had read. But we had a system, and so did most other people, by which if a man wanted to write something in confidential home, he used to go to his officer and say he wanted to send a confidential letter, and the officer then signed it blind. Not the thing perhaps that the MI5 would have approved of, but that's what we did. I used to say, when asked for a confidential letter, as I was once or twice, all right, you know, don't you, that if you've been careless and put some military information in, such as where we were, not only will you be court-martialed, but I shall too. And that was enough.
What sort of things would there be in their normal letters? Did you read them closely to check?
Well, I had to read hundreds and hundreds of letters. We didn't like it. We would much prefer not to, but there it was. You had to get through the job and write and sign and sign and sign. The letters were all very much the same, asking about things. And what the men mostly wanted to know was what things were like in their hometowns. They liked local news, most of all. Sometimes they got local papers sent out to them. They were not interested in national news.
Did you write home at all? Or did you
I wrote constantly. I wrote to my mother. My father, of course, was in Mesopotamia, so I couldn't very well write to him, but I wrote to my mother in England.
What sort of things did you write to her? Did your letters parallel your men's in a way? Or?
I should think so. I wasn't, of course, able any more than them to give any information that was really interesting. So I used to give what I could about my... And I used to try and give the impression that this is rather important, that I was not being driven to despair, because I wasn't. I was extremely happy.
What about your letters from home, the ones sent back?
Oh, well, what about them?
What sort of subjects would they cover? Were they important to you? Or?
About the family, what was happening to the family, and any news of my many cousins, of whom I had an enormous quantity. But they were mostly dead by 1917.
Were letters important to you? I mean, did you look forward to them?
Oh, yes, they certainly were. I think that any reasonable army looks after its letters. The Germans were very careful, let their men have plenty of opportunity to write home. The only army I know of that apparently had no system at all for communication with home was the Russians. I think they had absolutely no system at all.
What about parcels? Did you get parcels?
Oh, yes, occasionally. The men... I remember many references in the letters, as I censored, to the parcels. Always spelled P-A-R-C-L-E. They were much appreciated. I did, too. I got things.
What sort of things would be in your parcels?
Oh, things like... perhaps put a sauce or something that would help with the food. Drink we mostly bought locally for the mess.
What were drinking habits like in your mess?
Pretty moderate in mine. We had no drinker in my mess. The young major. I suppose nearly a teetotaler, really. He would take an occasional drink, but he never drank much. The captain wasn't there. He was always, we always had an absent captain. I was a child who'd only recently tasted alcohol.
You didn't drink then?
Oh, I did. I used we used to buy Barsack and buy, drink that.
But you wouldn't get drunk.
Oh no, our Canadian was capable of taking a lot on board, but I can't ever remember his being drunk. Oh no, no, the only times we got drunk were out of the line at Christmas in 1917.
I suspect we'll come to that. Now, how long you had these 3 days, one at the FOO, one at the billets, sorry, and one at the post,
one at the battery position. Yeah.
How long did that little sequence go on for before you'd be pulled back out of the line?
Ah, well, we, my battery was put in the line before I joined it, before the 31st of July 1917. I joined it in August. We were left in the line, and it's a long stretch, until just before Christmas.
So you were on that 3 day sequence throughout that time. Yes. How did that affect your personal morale, so to speak? Did you start to get jumpy or jittery? Or
oh, no, I don't think I did. Not then. I was conscious of beginning to get a bit jumpy, as I'll tell you when I come to it, in 1918. But during 17, and most of 18, I can't say that I felt jittery. Yeah.
Did you ever get chance to reduce the stress by getting away from it all? Major went to Poppering. Was that?
Yes. We used occasionally when we were off duty, perhaps.
This would be on the third day.
Yes. Well, if it was my day in billets, and there would be another subaltern whose day it was also, and perhaps, maybe a third. Off we used to go in a motorcycle and sidecar to Poppering, and we used to have a tremendous meal at a restaurant called Cyril's in Poppering. There were two that were favoured by. We had the very undemocratic system, you see, that restaurants were not open to the other ranks. They had the canteens, which were very well run, and that organization, I've forgotten the name of it, Tockage, and they told us that they'd had a very good time. I hope they have.
What sort of meal would you get?
Well, you used to get a sort of effort at a French meal, you know, with things we wouldn't normally get in restaurants at home.
Was there any civilians? Were there many civilians at all?
No civilians. I didn't meet civilians at all until later in 1918. Where I had a story for you, but
so the restaurant was run by the military authorities.
Oh no, it was purely it's Belgian. Oh no, quite private enterprise.
But there weren't any other civilians in Poppering.
There must have been one or two waitresses, I think. I can't remember them, but I think there must have been, but not very many.
With all this being away from civilians, did you miss not seeing women or that sort of thing?
Well, of course, I was very young, remember. I think that aspect worried some of the older men quite a lot. it made them jumpy. I remember there was one case where a man I didn't know personally, but he was a captain, I think, and he was getting on in age. And he applied for special leave. You could get a week's special leave to go to Paris or and he was asked for his reason, and he put quite boldly, sexual starvation. And to everybody's surprise and delight, he got his leave. He went off, and we hope he satisfied his needs in Paris. But for me, I was too young to suffer particularly from that. I don't want to anticipate all the things that happened in 1918.